No algorithm has ever cried during a tearjerker, or laughed at a comedy, or watched a single movie for that matter, which is why an algorithm has no business choosing your films. Mubi is a curated online cinema streaming exceptional films from around the globe. Every day they introduce a new gem and you have 1 month to watch it. Right now they're featuring brand new films from around the world that are playing at this year's New York Film Festival, as well as classics like David Lean's Breaking the Sound Barrier. Whether it's a timeless classic, a festival darling, or an acclaimed masterpiece, each film is hand-selected by experts. Malton on Movies listeners are invited to try Mubi free for 30 days at mubi.com/Malton. That's my name, Malton, M-A-L-T-I-N. So give Mubi a try. And thanks to Mubi for sponsoring Malton on Movies.
Now entering Nerdist.com.
Hi, everybody. I'm Leonard Malton.
And I'm Jesse Malton.
You're listening to Malton on Movies. And tonight we are coming to you yet again from Fantastic Fest in Austin, Texas.
Well done.
And our guest tonight is a resident of the selfsame Austin, Texas, and a resident of the world, because he's world-renowned, Elijah Wood.
Hello.
Welcome.
Thank you. That was one of my favorite introductions ever.
Well, thank you.
Resident of the world.
You are. Well, you are. And, well, heck, you spent so much of your time on the bottom half of the world.
It's true, I did.
Is that how they want to be known, though?
The bottom half?
The bottom half of the world.
Maybe not.
No.
No, but there is a sense of isolation and remoteness, I know, because we have visited New Zealand.
Yeah, she was just telling
and,
me.
Yeah. And they, I think they have, not an inferiority complex, but no, I'm not saying that, but I'm saying that they do feel somehow forgotten or that they're off the map a little bit. And Peter Jackson has done a lot to put them on the map and in people's consciousness. And I know they're grateful to him for that and to those films because tourism is up.
Massively, yeah.
Yeah. And
real estate is up.
Yes.
I remember we were making the films and so many of us wanted to go back to New Zealand and buy houses. And at the time, you know, the American dollar was really good there. So you'd get double your money if you go to New Zealand.
Yeah.
And the housing prices were pretty low. So you could get amazing property for nothing. That is not the case anymore.
No.
Yeah.
Really missed my opportunity.
We were there and we were standing outside of his studio with Peter Jackson as a tour bus went by.
Yeah.
And everyone, this is when he initially lost all that weight. And so people really didn't recognize him.
Oh, right. So before The Hobbit even started shooting,
yeah,
probably.
Yeah,
this, oh, right,
is a,
okay.
This is a few years ago.
Oh, yeah.
And we were standing there, and the bus, everybody on the bus kind of squinted and stared. They're like, is that Peter Jackson? And also, who's the guy with the beard? But is that Peter Jackson? And it was really funny. But they do. He's like a god. And they love that he shows up to his premieres barefoot.
Yeah.
They feel that's a true Kiwi way of life.
It is, yeah.
And it's amazing.
Yeah, there's a lot of ingenuity, though, too. I mean, I don't know if it's the fact that they're so far removed or far away from the rest of the world, but there is this thing of, like, it was very, very apparent on working on Lord of the Rings, and I think it's just a part of being a Kiwi, is you just kind of pull yourself up by your bootstraps, and you do everything that you can to get the job done.
Yeah.
Any way and any kind of creative means. And it's a lot of people working together in a kind of team and as a family, to just, even if it's not in their job description, they'll be like, I'll pick that job up and do that to get the thing done.
Yeah.
And I've never really seen that culturally anywhere else. It's really very specific to New Zealand.
No, they're wonderful people.
They are.
They're wonderful people. Yeah. And we met some great folks down there.
We did, yeah.
And we got a tour of one of the most spectacular movie palaces we've ever seen in Auckland, which they have restored to a fairly well. It's a 1929 atmospheric movie palace. Atmospheric palaces, movie palaces, are ones with clouds and stars in the ceiling.
Oh, yes.
Yeah,
is that what they're called?
Yeah.
Okay. Atmospheric.
And they had just done a fantastic job. And when we were there, the mayor happened to be visiting with some group or other. And I was introduced to him, and I said, this is a world-class movie theater. He said, it is? I said, believe me, I'm a movie theater buff. Everywhere I travel, I go to see these restored theaters. Yours is one of the greatest I've ever seen. And he incorporated that into his speech.
Yeah.
So he was very proud for a visitor from, you know, up there in the States.
To validate his...
To validate
yeah.
that. And I was, which I genuinely meant. So that's when I got a sense that maybe they need that validation or want that validation.
Well, their own national anthem is a little bit like
oh, yeah.
reserved.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
Oh, please take kindness on New Zealand. Hey, we have no quarrels. We're just over here. It's very much the tone. So I guess it is kind of yeah. a cultural thing. That is funny.
Just wonderful. Just beautiful.
And is it the Paramount Theater in Wellington? Have you seen that?
That's we didn't get to see that.
Has anyone here been to the Paramount Theater? Oh, the Embassy. That's it, the Embassy. Thank mm-hmm. you. But you whooped for the Paramount. the Embassy is a very old theater that Peter has restored. It's really,
yes,
really
wonderful,
restored.
Wonderful. Jesse and I were talking before. We were doing our sort of homework.
Okay.
Yeah,
I was wondering.
To be prepared to talk to you. And we realized that it's just a fact of life that we've all watched you grow. We've lived with you. Mm-hmm. We've watched you grow up on screen. And for someone Jesse's age, she's never not known of you.
Yeah.
You know.
We're about the same age. You're a little bit older. And I was trying to figure out when the first time I saw you was and if I had any memory where you didn't exist. And the answer is no. You've always existed.
Bizarre.
I know, right? I know.
Wow. I honestly can't compute that.
It's
really
crazy.
Strange.
I know. Well, that's how I feel. is I see, you know, there's certain people where in my mind, however old I was, that was about how old you were. Mm-hmm. And you were just always there because you worked consistently. Mm-hmm. As I got older, so did you. So you were just always there. And I know. Look, I stopped sleeping outside your house. I obeyed that weird thing with the law where I'm not allowed to be within 10 feet. But here we are. No, it is. It's a strange thing. And I know as an actor, it's crazy even for you guys to be able to look back mm-hmm. at yourself at a certain age. I mean, another crazy point for us is that my dad's assistant for many, many years was one of your mothers in North. The topless African mother.
Oh my God.
Yeah. So.
I remember her.
Yeah.
How could I forget?
That's
I was 12.
Yep.
She
yep.
was topless.
And she
yep.
was exactly.
Yeah.
Yep.
That's
Darwin Carson is her
Carson.
Name, and
uh-huh.
she was my dad's assistant for yep. a long time. And yep. when she told me that, I said she can never leave. Because that's the coolest credit anyone has ever. You don't even see her face in the movie. You literally don't see her face. You see him, and he comes up to you about here, and then just boobs.
Yeah.
So, oh, acting. but yeah, I mean, so you were you 8 or 9?
When I started?
Yeah.
I was 8.
He was 8. Holy
yeah. yeah.
That's, you're an overachiever like him, aren't you? It's one of these. Oh.
How did it begin for you?
Yeah.
It sort of started with, I was born in Iowa. Mm-hmm. And I had a lot of energy as a child. My mom, the story kind of goes that my mom was watching TV one day. She saw a commercial. And she was like, oh, that would be a fun thing for Elijah to do as an outlet for his energy. but there was no real outlet for that kind of thing in Cedar Rapids, Iowa.
Mm-hmm.
So I ended up going, this is a very roundabout way to get into acting. I went to a modeling school that had some sort of acting component to it, and I did some actual like modeling, including runway modeling at a local mall. Anyway, long story short, that modeling school kind of represented some of their kind of students at this modeling and talent convention in Los Angeles that my brother, my mom, and I traveled to, and I kind of competed in this sort of competition. And there were sort of talent managers and agents, and this manager approached me. And I was 7 at the time, and he said, do you want to be an actor? And it was sort of abstract, but the whole thing was so fantastical to me. I was in Los Angeles for the first time, seeing, you know, palm trees, and all of it was so kind of surreal. And the notion of being an actor was also kind of surreal to me. It wasn't something I could kind of wrap my head around. but it seemed exciting. So I said, yeah, that would be really fun. I was sort of game for anything. And we, my mom, my brother, and I moved to LA for just a trial period to see about auditioning and maybe I'd do some commercials. And my brother was also auditioning at the time as well. And I did a number of auditions, and I got my first job. It was a Paula Abdul music video. And it was actually directed by David Fincher before he started making films, funnily enough. And I loved it. And I did a number of commercials after that. And then I got my first job in a film shortly thereafter in Back to the Future 2 mm-hmm. in the Cafe 80s, trying to work the video game at the back mm-hmm. of the cafe. And I just fell in love with it. It kind of all happened weirdly, organically. And I just had this sort of enthusiasm for playing characters. And I had a weird... It's interesting to talk about this now, being 36 and having the experience that I've had and an understanding of filmmaking that I currently have mm-hmm. and try and put myself into the 8-year-old brain.
Yeah.
I genuinely can't.
Yeah.
All I know is I somehow knew what I was doing and just enjoyed it. And that's kind of how it started.
Mm-hmm. Well, and obviously other people thought you knew what you were doing too.
I guess.
Yeah.
Or you wouldn't have gotten the jobs.
Right.
David Fincher and Robert Zemeckis were your first two directors.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. And
that's pretty wild.
Not bad.
Not bad.
Did you... You know, some kids, some child actors take it as make-believe, or that's how it's presented to them. Mm-hmm. And some of them seem to have an advanced wisdom beyond their years, perhaps, mm-hmm. that it is a job, and they take it very responsibly as a job. Do you remember what your attitude was, what your outlook was, or how you were encouraged to... deal with all this?
Yeah, from the perspective of what I was doing as an actor, my understanding was make-believe definitely, but also imbuing a sense of reality into the characters that I was playing.
Mm-hmm.
That was kind of the one thing that I had that I understood, that I was trying to not act. That I was conscious of. Mm-hmm. That notion of acting mm-hmm. versus being in the mm-hmm. moment and being mm-hmm. real. Weirdly cognizant of that at 8 years and 9 years of age.
Mm-hmm.
So that was my focus. I suppose I looked at it as a job, but it was also an exploration for me. And I think it was a creative, not an outlet, but a creative expression and an ability. What I loved about it was interacting with humans.
Sure.
I liked working with people, and I had this understanding of this character that I had to play somehow, and I enjoyed the interaction on set and working with a group of people on this thing that we were all working on.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that has always been my true love, not just simply playing a character, but going on location with a team, working on a film and making something together. And I was aware of that, I think, mm-hmm. at a young age as well.
Do you remember... This is a big question, but because you were so busy, very young, mm. you started working a lot. Do you remember any actors in particular who impressed you? Not just as people, or they were nice to you, or something like that, but mm-hmm. but working with them, you thought, boy, that woman, that man, they're really good. They really know what they're doing, or something. Anyone stand out? I'm looking at the cast list of some of these films, and there's a lot of heavyweight names there.
Yeah, immediately Aidan Quinn comes to mind
mm-hmm.
from Avalon, mm-hmm. played my father. Elizabeth Perkins, mm-hmm. played my mother.
Mm-hmm.
They were incredible, both because they were my parents in the film, so they treated me with that. They established that kind of relationship mm-hmm. with me in a really kind and mm-hmm. and beautiful way. But they were also incredible actors that
yes.
I think I was aware of the craft of what they were doing.
Mm-hmm.
Oh my God, man. There's so many.
So many. As I say, I look at the cast list of just Huck Finn and the Ice Storm. I
mean, yeah, Courtney Vance.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Was extraordinary to watch mm-hmm. and incredible to work with. And all of these people would, you know, inspire me. I mean, you are only as good an actor as the people you work opposite, and mm-hmm. all of these people were so incredible at what they were doing, and I was literally learning how to do this as I was going. I didn't have any formal training. I didn't go to drama school. I think I took a couple of improv classes when I was young. So every experience I would have on a film would be a new learning experience. And those actors that I worked opposite were my teachers, you know.
Well, some of the films you made as a kid, as a real youngster, were pretty intense.
We were talking about how dark.
You know, Huckleberry Finn, you know, Ron Perlman scenes as Pap.
Oh my God, yeah, Ron Perlman, right?
I mean,
yeah, Jesus. Yeah. It's weird. I haven't talked about these movies in so long.
And, you know, scared the bejesus out of her.
He sent me, I was six and I went running out of the theater.
He was terrifying in that film.
My dad tried to make me stay. He said, it can't get worse than this. And in the next scene, the kid gets shot and you're holding him in a river mud coming over and there's blood everywhere. And I was just out the door. And then the publicist from Disney is calling him in a panic, like, oh God, what happened? He's like, well, you shouldn't have brought a six-year-old to see that movie, should you? It didn't go well.
Yeah.
But you've always been good and you've always been able to handle it. Because I think about like The Good Son, where you're next to Macaulay Culkin, who didn't get to do very much dramatic stuff because we knew him as the, you know, but...
Sure.
That's the best way to describe him, isn't it? But, you know, working with him.
Yeah.
And he's evil.
Yeah.
And you have to handle that. But you're also a kid.
Yeah.
You took on a lot at a very young age. Then I don't know that everybody would have understood how to play that.
It's weird. I think I was weirdly conscious of... And again, I don't know how. Partially maybe due to my mother. I have to give my mother an immense amount of credit. I would not be where I am had it not been for her shepherding me through that process and guiding me through it in a way that gave my life integrity as well as upheld the integrity of my childhood. In an industry that, you know, can send people in varying ways.
Yeah.
It was always so important to my mother, far more important, rather, that I have a healthy life and a wonderful family and a childhood than, you know, have an industry, be successful in the industry. So she had a lot to do with that. But I was very conscious at a young age, for some reason, of being aware of other child actors being only in family-oriented films. And wanting to play roles that were challenging or different, or to exist in films that weren't just for kids.
Yeah.
I don't know if I was conscious of the notion of being typecast or being pigeonholed into something, but I think it was sort of subconsciously or consciously about that too, wanting to do things that didn't necessarily only exist in one sphere in regards to filmmaking. And I think that's why there are some of those darker films. And were you
able to shake that off at the end of a shoot, or at the end of the day, at the end of the work day?
Yeah. Yeah, I never took work home with me for some, like emotionally.
Good, I mean, that's good.
Anything that was slightly dark or uncomfortable in terms of the subject matter in a film, psychically it didn't impact me. I was able to, you know, I remember they would call cut and I would sort of be laughing about something and then we would sort of dive into something else.
And that's probably why you're a pleasant and happy human being today. that would hopefully carry over.
That, and also it seems any
it's the parents, it's always your parents.
Parents.
It really is.
Any child
and
actor who has survived and thrived, it seems to me, has done so because of strong parenting.
Foundation.
And solid family life.
Yeah.
And the ones, conversely, the ones who've had troubles, serious troubles, seem to have, you know, an absence of that in their lives.
Exactly.
And
an absence of love, an absence of there being foundation, you know. This industry is so bizarre because it sort of almost asks you to define yourself based on your success or the things that you've achieved rather than defining yourself based on yourself, your own growth, your own internal life. And I was always told to sort of define myself by me. And that is, it's so simple, but ultimately that's what keeps you kind of on a much healthier path.
Right. For some people, it hasn't been so simple, though. And that's, you know, that's the stark contrast between you and some of your contemporaries and some of the kids that came before you, decades before you.
Sure.
I met Shirley Temple. I got to interview Shirley Temple.
Did you really?
Yes. And she was, I just read her book. She wrote a really interesting autobiography. Mm. And I got to go and visit her. She lived in Hillsborough, Northern California. Mm-hmm. And she was really nice and everything you would sort of want her to be. And she had children and grandchildren. She was teaching one of her grandkids to tap dance.
Oh, my God.
Which was just glorious.
How old was she at the time?
Well, she would have been
3 months.
70-something, I think.
Yeah.
If I'm remembering correctly.
Yeah.
And she made sandwiches for the crew.
Oh, my God.
You know, just a dream day for all of us, and I got to go back a second time.
Is this an interview that we can see or read?
Some stuff might be online, because I find a lot of your interviews.
It was done for Entertainment Tonight.
Oh, it was?
When I was working for Entertainment Tonight.
A lot of it's on YouTube. A lot of the interviews are on YouTube. Yeah. Maybe it is.
I wish they would make that.
Entertainment Tonight, by the way.
Well, thank you.
That was such a big part of...
It was such a popular show at that time. It was the only show of its kind.
Yeah.
And I had these golden opportunities presented to me because of it. And I wish they would put all that stuff out from their vault.
They really should.
It's one of these days.
Well, maybe, that's a historic document. Like, that should be available for people to see.
It is for me. She had all her scripts bound, you know, and I could sort of go and read all the names of these famous films that I'd grown up watching on television. And but she was very solid, and because she had a very normal home life. Mm-hmm. She had a brother. She had, you know, her father and mother, they had dinner at the dinner table every single night. Mm-hmm. But she said what saved her, she had never gone to school. She hadn't even gone to the studio school. She had a private tutor until she was about 11 or so. And then Daryl Zanuck fired her when she ceased to be cute and ceased to be a moneymaker for
that
his studio.
Fucking Zanuck.
Yeah. And so her mother enrolled her in, I think, the Westlake School.
Yeah.
And a private school for girls in Los Angeles.
Yeah.
And so it, like, on the cusp of puberty, she had to learn to socialize and, you know, and relate to other kids her age for the first time.
That's heavy.
Imagine. But she said that's what changed her life and saved her life.
Yeah.
And you can understand from that how she became a diplomat in later years, mm-hmm. which is what she did. She worked for the UN. She had Ronald Reagan had her as an ambassador. Mm-hmm. I think she always got it. I think she always understood. Again, just something in there that clicked, that worked.
Yeah.
And you've got it because you've carved your own niche as an adult. You've gone into production. Mm-hmm. You're working, you know, not only as an actor, you're still working as an actor, mm-hmm. but you're also involved in the creation of projects, mm-hmm. and so you don't have resentment or bitterness looking back, you know, at things you did when you were a kid.
No, not even Flipper.
You beat me to my punchline, mister.
No, I stole it.
You beat me to my punchline, damn it. So how was that dolphin?
I thought you were a wonderful dolphin. I think you killed it as a dolphin. Yeah. You should do it again.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
It's a lot of training.
It's the eyes. That's what it was. I'm trying to do the voice like, can't. I got nothing.
Did you enjoy working with the dolphin?
I did, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean,
who wouldn't enjoy working with a dolphin?
I know.
It's amazing.
Not making excuses here, but that was seriously why I did the movie.
You don't have to make excuses.
No excuses necessary.
I got to go and live in the Bahamas for, you know, 2 months and swim with dolphins. It was great.
Wow.
Yeah, and hang out with Paul Hogan.
Yeah.
It was great.
Yes.
There's no downside, honestly. There's no downside.
I agree.
And I like the movie.
Dear.
Okay.
I liked it. I haven't
seen it in years, so I can't judge you.
I have 300 copies of it on VHS. No, I don't. I wish I did.
And I'm going to jump out of order for 1 second because you're talking about relating to other actors and being part of an ensemble and being part of a troupe,
mm-hmm.
And how much that appealed to you as a young person. But it's the opposite experience when you voice a character in an animated film, oh, and yeah. often you have to work by yourself. Mm-hmm. I'm thinking about Mumbles and Happy Feet.
Yeah.
Now, did they do it that way? Were you isolated and only working with your director?
A lot of the time that is the case with mm-hmm. animation.
So you've done a lot now.
I have, yeah, a fair amount. I love it. It's so much fun.
Mm-hmm. And video games, too.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, Over the Garden Wall, if anyone's seen that, it's an animated miniseries that was on Cartoon Network a couple years back, mm-hmm. and they keep playing it. I did a lot of my voice stuff on that with the young boy who plays my brother.
Mm-hmm.
So that was great, that core relationship we had. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it is a thing with animation that more often than not, you are kind of isolated because it comes down to actors' schedules. They don't have to have everyone in the same room.
Mm-hmm.
So if everyone isn't technically available at the same time, it's easy enough to just...
Right, plus, yeah. plus they want multiple takes, readings on the line.
Sure.
And stuff like that.
But with Happy Feet, that was the only time I've ever, for the sequel actually, we all went to Australia and had the entire cast in one room.
Oh my.
All the time. So for an entire month, we'd go into the studio, into this giant big room, every single day, and have all of the cast present for every single sequence.
That sounds amazing.
Which was a joy. Everybody was playing off of each other. Robin Williams and these incredible comedic actors who were playing so many of the penguins as well. So we had this great interplay that was happening with George at the helm of it.
George Miller.
Kind of almost like a conductor to these voice actors and comedians. It was amazing. So that was the opposite experience that you typically have.
I've never heard of that happening on
Not to that degree.
Feature. No, you don't often get that.
And just Robin Williams alone in that room. Boy.
Yeah. An absolute joy. One of my favorite memories in my life is getting to know him a little bit and mm-hmm. work with him. He was a true delight and so extraordinarily talented.
Wow.
Yeah.
All right. Do you remember the first time you heard about the Lord of the Rings project? Do you remember who...
Hang on. Don't jump there yet.
We're
almost there. But
we're
that is a saga.
Okay.
So...
It actually is.
I know, right?
That's accurate.
But before we get to the saga...
No. There was a movie I was telling you about that not a lot of people know, The Bumblebee Flies Anyway.
Okay.
And I don't know if you know this, but that is used a lot in hospitals. And
is
it's
it really?
And it's how I was introduced to it. I have, like, lupus and rheumatoid arthritis and a whole bunch of things. And some of my nurses... talk to me about this because it was, you know, then the internet, not so much yet to the degree it is now where mm-hmm. people have chat rooms if they want them or mostly it was just sort of your doctors, your nurses and sitting in a waiting room with other people. And someone said, no, there's this really lovely movie that you should watch called The Bumblebee Flies Anyway. And I saw it. And then it would be on TV. It was on TV quite a bit some years ago. It would just kind of be playing randomly.
And I haven't seen that movie in... well over a decade.
It holds up.
Does it?
Yeah.
Wow, okay.
And I love it, and I still love it.
Wow.
And it's Rachel Lee Cook, and it's just, it's a wonderful movie, but I didn't know if you had any idea or not. But it means a lot to I call us fancy cripples. That's my nickname for my people.
Okay, I love that.
Yeah, well, because we're the hidden ones, so you can't tell that we're broken because mm-hmm. we're fabulous. But yeah, so we're fancy cripples, and it is such a good movie to watch when you need to sort of get out of your own body.
Yeah,
and it's a beautiful film.
Wow.
Has anybody seen it or heard of it?
So nice
I know
hear.
That it's not something
Boy.
That... Yeah, that
yeah.
many.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's really great, still.
Oh, man.
And I still recommend
so
it to
nice
people.
To hear.
Yeah, I still show it to
It makes
to
me
people.
Want to rewatch it, because it's literally
you should.
Been
it's a
well
lovely
over
film.
10 years.
And all of you should watch it. It's a lovely film. The Bumblebee Flies Anyway.
Wow.
Yeah. Now, you
the
may
saga?
Proceed into the saga.
The saga.
Yes.
Where did it begin for you, and how did it begin for you?
It began in Austin, Texas.
No kidding.
Isn't that funny? I was working on The Faculty.
Mm-hmm. Oh, for Robert Rodriguez.
Yeah, Robert Rodriguez is The Faculty. Mm-hmm. And Harry Knowles mentioned it to me. Ain't it cool news?
Mm-hmm.
And he had said that, hey man, Peter Jackson is going to be making this movie. He's going to be making Lord of the Rings, and you should play Frodo. And this is probably, so this is 97. They didn't actually get the movie greenlit until 1999 when they started the casting process. I think it was actually end of 98, early 99. So that was the first time I'd heard about it, was here in Austin. And it was abstract. It wasn't a thing that they were casting, but it was this idea that this person, who I loved because he directed Heavenly Creatures, one of my favorite movies, and I thought, amazing. Oh, well, that's the perfect person for it. This is someone who understands the kind of intimate moments between humans and emotion, and can elicit those incredible emotional performances, but also delves into the fantastical with those incredible sort of stop motion, you know, animated sequences and the world that those characters go to. It's like, that's so perfect. Anyway, cut to about a year and a half later, I get a call from my agent, and she said, they're casting the Lord of the Rings. They want you to put yourself on tape or go in and meet the casting agent. And I asked if Peter Jackson was going to be making rounds, and they said, well, yeah, but you're going to need to go in and you know, before he comes to Los Angeles, you'll have to go into the casting office. And I thought, well, I really want this. I want to do something special because everyone is auditioning for these roles. I want to do something that can sort of stand out and take control of the situation on some level. And I'd never done that in my life. I'd never been inspired to. I'd never had a thought of, I'm going to go make a tape in the woods somewhere. But I did. I went and got a book on hobbits and got a sense of what they look like. Went to Western Costume in Los Angeles and got a
best place.
Like the knee-high pants and the breeches and the whole thing. And my friend George Wang, who directed Swimming with Sharks, do you know that movie, Swimming with Sharks?
Yeah.
Great, great movie. He shot it and kind of helped me cut the footage together. And there were three audition scenes that they sent out for that particular role. One with Gandalf coming into Bag End that we shot at my house. And then we went into the woods and did two scenes from part two and three that sort of just show the various colors of the experience that Frodo goes through. Shot those scenes, variety of angles, cut the footage together at the Miramax offices that night. And then I sent, it was a VHS tape, because that's what
yeah.
it was. And I took the VHS tape to the casting office that next day, and then they FedExed it to Peter. So that's kind of how it all happened. And then Peter ultimately came back to Los Angeles, and I met him in person with Fran, and I was so excited to meet Fran because I knew she was instrumental.
That's Fran Walsh, his
Fran
wife
Walsh.
And screenwriting partner.
Yeah, yeah. And she was instrumental in the writing of Heavenly Creatures, and I love that film. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I sort of did the audition again for them. And then about 3 months later, I think it was, I was at home and I got a phone call from my agent, and she said, you're gonna be getting a call, make sure you pick up the phone. And then the phone rang 10 minutes later, and it was Peter's assistant, Jan. She said, hi, I'm Jan, I'm Peter's assistant. Peter Jackson's assistant. I have Peter Jackson for you. I was like, oh, man. And then he just sort of said, hi, Elijah, would you like to come down to New Zealand and play Frodo?
Man.
And that's sort of how
but that was three. But again, the life of an actor, right? The glamorous life of an actor. You went the extra mile and took the initiative to do what you did to show him not only how you would play the part and to persuade him you were the right person for the part, but that you really wanted to play the part.
That
so
was
badly,
the thing, yeah.
Which must, you know, have a tremendous effect on any filmmaker when an actor does that.
A man who puts on britches.
That's right.
It's a man who cares.
That's right.
That's it.
But it was the britches.
It was the britches.
But then the way the business works, and it's not anybody, you know, being malicious or anything, but things take time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
3 months before that phone call came. Wow.
Yeah. It was a long time.
But then it came.
Yeah.
Now, did you know at that moment how long you would be living in New Zealand, living and working in New Zealand? Did they know? Did even they know that at that moment?
I think they did. They knew that they were shooting all three movies at the same time, and they knew that it would roughly take a year. So yeah, I think we were all aware, and that was actually part of the decision-making process for the people that were asked to join the film was. Mm-hmm. You are going to be leaving your lives for up to 16 months. And so any other prior commitments or anything that you might want to be doing in that span of time, you have to give those things up.
Right.
I was 18, so there wasn't anything. There wasn't really anything on the horizon that I needed. This was the thing. I was quite happy to go. But yeah, it was a major consideration for a lot of people to leave their lives. Families, you know, Sean Astin brought his entire family to New Zealand and they lived there with him. I mean, it literally was us transporting our lives to another country for the duration of the filming. And it was extraordinary.
And you, I mean, from what I've heard, what we've heard and read, you really did bond in a way that very few casts or ensembles and crews get to bond, because you were living and working together for over a year.
Yeah.
And that's really unusual.
It is. Yeah, and we all, it was very palpable too. We had 2 months of rehearsal and preparations before we started shooting. And even in that time, we were all spending all of our time together and preparing together. And there was this sense that we were about to take an adventure together that we would remember for the rest of our lives. And it was so palpable. And it ended up being true, of course. Yeah. And we did form a kind of fellowship, and we did form a family as a result of the time that we spent together. Which is really, I mean, it's a testament to not just the people, but also Peter and Fran and their casting choices. They were also, as much as they wanted to cast the roles appropriately, they were also very conscious about filling those roles with people that they liked.
Yeah.
And that was important
to
them.
They're stuck with them too.
Yeah.
I mean,
for a long time.
Yeah. And you can't have a diva for 16 months.
And there weren't any. There weren't any. There were only people there that wanted to do the hard work. And it was hard, you know? 6 day weeks, 16 hour days. It was impossibly hard. And yet everyone would get up the next day with the same level of enthusiasm month nine as they had in month one, you know?
Boy. I don't suppose there's any way to really convey the fullness of that to us, to anybody who didn't live it with you.
There isn't. And it's interesting, actually, that you say that specifically, because I remember that feeling when I got back to Los Angeles after we were finished with principal photography. It was a little overwhelming. I didn't quite know what to make of my own life anymore. It had been so defined by that experience for so long. And the primary thing I found difficult was trying to articulate to people what it was like. You know, I'd see family and friends, and they would ask me, like, what was it like being in New Zealand? And a million questions. And no matter how many of those questions I answered, it still didn't quite equate to what it felt like being there. And I think the best version of that that you can get is the appendices and the DVDs. There's so many documentaries that very well articulate kind of every aspect of the production. And that's probably as close as you can get.
It's kind of like when you're at summer camp and that becomes your family and that becomes your world and everything else is gone. And then you come home and you get depressed.
Or university, I imagine,
any
for
of it,
people.
Any of it. I've gone to the Edinburgh Fringe.
Oh, man, Edinburgh is so beautiful.
It's my favorite. It's where I met my husband.
Oh, no way.
It's where I met my husband. Let's all embarrass him. It's where I met... Sorry, honey. and when we met, so we were there, it's 8 weeks, no sleep, you don't eat, you're sleeping on top of each other, sometimes by choice, and it's just like, it's madness.
Yeah.
And the flight home was one of the most depressing experiences of my existence. And then getting back... And it's, you know, it's that, I think that's the closest anybody could understand to what you've been through.
Yeah.
That when everyone goes, well, tell us all about it, you say, I don't know how to begin to explain. So that's the only way I think you could really tell someone what it was, is that it's like when you get to sort of disappear and you come back and now what?
Now you found yourself at that moment in your life and career with a tough act to follow.
Yeah.
I mean, those three extraordinary films that represent a formidable, I was going to say towering achievement, but I'm trying not to pun, but...
I love puns, Leonard.
Well, it was a towering achievement, but it was that. And what do you do next? And I'm sure you weren't the only one who asked themselves that very question.
Yeah.
What do you do next? How did you start to reacclimate and gather yourself together
I remember feeling that the first I didn't want to work for a while. I just wanted to take a breather.
Sure.
But I was conscious of the next thing being really small.
Mm-hmm.
And I worked on an Ed Burns film called Ash Wednesday that mm-hmm. probably no one's seen. I shot it. He shot the entire movie, I think, in 15 or 16 days or something. Mm-hmm. It was really quick. But it was perfect. Like, that opportunity came up. I thought, this is great. I'll go to New York, and I'll just do this thing with a bunch of actors, and I'll be in and out, and there's not 2 hours in makeup, and I don't have a wig, and
yeah.
and it's just focusing on a group of people in rooms. It's yeah. really simple.
Yeah.
So that was very conscious to me,
mm-hmm.
both on a kind of experiential level, but also the strategic part of it was, and I'm never really strategically minded mm-hmm. beyond just not wanting to have to follow a path. And mm-hmm. after Lord of the Rings, in my mind, I thought, well, that will always be a singular thing. I will never be a part of anything else in my life mm-hmm. that will reach those heights and be as massive as yeah. those films. So I'm not even going to try. I just want to simply work on things that are different.
Mm-hmm.
And so as not... The one thing I think I was conscious of was so as not to sort of pigeonhole myself or for people to only focus on Frodo Baggins and that role,
mm-hmm.
I thought, well, I'll just keep working. And as long as I keep working and working on things that are very different from that,
mm-hmm.
I'll get outside of whatever potential shadow that can mm-hmm. cast. Mm-hmm.
How nice, this is jumping ahead, but how nice that having been an admirer of Heavenly Creatures,
you got to work with Melanie Lynskey.
With Melanie Lynskey just this past year.
In a movie that is
a Sundance Prize winning movie.
Really, really good. And oh, you're really good.
Thank
She's
you.
She's amazing. I love that woman. We got to have her on the podcast.
Isn't she incredible?
The name, I always get the name wrong, though, because
I don't feel at home in this world anymore.
I don't feel at home in this world anymore.
Yeah.
If you haven't seen it.
He only keeps me because he can never remember the name of anything.
It's terrific.
That woman right there produced it, my girlfriend.
Oh, great. Well, we're
great
fans.
Movie. Now, wait, now we can embarrass your girlfriend. It's his girlfriend.
We're fans of that movie,
Jesse. Isn't it?
Yeah.
It's such an incredible film. Yeah. And Macon Blair actually lives here in Austin, Texas.
Yeah.
He's an incredible actor as well mm-hmm. in Green mm-hmm. Room and Blue Ruin.
Sure. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I was such a huge fan of his because of the film festival that we're at. I'd seen mm-hmm. both Blue Ruin and Green Room here mm-hmm. at Fantastic Fest. And so I was like a geeky nerd fan for him.
Mm-hmm.
And I met him at the festival like, oh my God, you're in Blue Ruin. I loved him so much. And he was like, oh, hey, dude, you live here too. And I got this script. I wrote this thing. Do you want to read it? I'm like, oh my God, yeah. I was so excited. And that's kind of the genesis of how that sort of started to come together. It was a longer story than that, but
yeah.
he's amazing. And I love that film. And also the opportunity to work with Melanie was a huge dream of mine too, because this is an actress who I have loved since Heavenly Creatures
mm-hmm.
and who... as from the in the acting world is so respected, but nobody knows her to play a leading role in a film.
Yeah.
No.
She's never played a leading role, and it's so frustrating for me.
Yeah. Yeah.
So the fact that Macon basically wrote something that she was the lead in the film made me so fucking happy.
Yeah.
It was just the best thing.
She is, I really do think she's one of the best actresses that exists. And she can do absolutely anything. I had no idea she was on Two and a Half Men
because
I'd never seen the show before.
Yeah,
and then
neither.
And then in researching for her to come on the show, it's like, what is she on? So then I found out that's how people know her.
Right,
and I kind
of
wanted
millions
to,
of people know.
Many,
right,
many, many people know her from that. I'd never seen it. I watched it, and of course she's good for what it is. She's good. But I can't imagine not knowing her doing everything else and every kind of accent.
Yeah.
And no, that movie is really good. And you get to do something different, which, so my nerdness is mm-hmm. when I get to see actors do something completely outside for them, when they get to try something fun and different, because I know, especially growing up with a lot of actors, that that doesn't happen all the time, that it's mm-hmm. really easy to get pigeonholed, mm-hmm. that you and your big blue eyes, you know, real quick, they just stick you there.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was neat to get to see that. And
now last
side.
Year, at South
Thank
by
you.
Southwest,
yeah.
I got to see a movie I really liked called The Trust, that you did with Nicolas Cage.
Oh, man.
And here's another one that sort of slipped through the cracks. But now no movie slips through the cracks entirely because you can access them.
Yeah, it's true. Thank goodness.
So there used to be an elephant burial ground for movies that died.
It's true. And
now they live. So I'm recommending The Trust. It's a caper movie, a heist movie about two crooked cops played by you and Nicolas Cage. So I know. I have to ask the obvious question, what's it like being in a scene opposite that guy?
Is it everything we want it to be?
I'm telling you right now, it is. It was an absolute dream come true. And it's the only time as an actor that I've had an out-of-body experience whilst being in a scene. So I would literally, and this would happen daily, where I'd work with him and we'd be having this moment and he'd be doing what he's doing, which is so incredible. And I would be out of my body, still speaking, like, oh, it's Nicolas Cage! Every single day. But man, what an incredible human, too, and a generous actor, and a present actor, and so smart, and so many ideas, self-aware, in a really beautiful, funny way, but also takes it so seriously. I'd have moments with him where he would say...
He named his kid Kal-El.
Oh, dude, yeah. There's some of him that lives on another planet entirely. No, it's incredible.
You named your kid Superman.
Superman.
Yeah. That's amazing.
It's awesome.
Superman Cage.
He also, like, bought castles. He has a mausoleum in New Orleans that's a pyramid.
He does.
He has a pyramid. I've seen it.
I love that man.
No, he's incredible.
Oh, my God.
But he loves it. He hasn't stopped loving the craft. We had a day...
That's wonderful.
I remember we finished a scene and he'd stopped and it was sort of downtime in between setups and he looked at me and he's like, isn't this the greatest job? And all he wants to do is work with young, interesting filmmakers who have a voice, you know?
Does he want to be best friends? That's what I need to know.
Good for him.
Yeah, you want to hang out with that guy.
I really do.
And my production company, we just produced a movie that he's in called Mandy that'll be coming out next year.
Oh, wonderful.
A filmmaker called Panos Cosmatos made a movie called Beyond the Black Rainbow that's incredible. Also played at Fantastic Fest many years ago, but so I got to kind of work with him again as a producer,
great.
And it was
that's
wonderful.
Great. What else is in your?
What's your production company called?
Yeah,
Spectrevision. But we also our parent company is Company X.
Okay.
And tell us some of the other things in the hopper for Company X.
We have a film called Corpse Tub that is a comedy. I love the title so much. It's a comedy.
You mean by the Fantastic Fest definition of comedy?
Sure.
Yeah.
It actually is really genuinely funny and very much a comedy.
Good.
The title makes it sound way more gruesome than it really is. It's Kate Micucci. It is a comedy about a couple who move into an apartment. They move into this apartment, and shortly after moving in, the apartment's broken into by this person who's a cult follower, and he commits suicide in their tub because... Years prior, the cult leader had committed suicide in that tub, and it has become a sort of beacon for his followers to join him on the other side. And it's about this couple dealing with this phenomena of their apartment being the sort of beacon for these deaths.
And laughter
ensues. It's very funny.
Yes, right, yes.
Taika Waititi is in it. There's an incredible cast of comedians that joined us. It's really very funny.
Wonderful. Are you enjoying producing?
I love it. I mean, I love it. As much, if not more, as I do working as an actor. I just love filmmaking. So at any level that I can be a part of the creative process with a group of people who are making something that I'm creatively excited about, whatever I can help in that process is how I want to be involved.
Community? Is that what it boils down to for you then? Being part of a active, engaging, congenial...
Yeah.
Creative
and
community.
That's why you moved to Austin.
I think we are on to something, guys.
Yeah,
I think, and that brings us also
here.
To this festival, which is very much built on community. And
so much.
This is not just a film festival, and I've been telling people this for years. This is a place where people meet, share their love of cinema, and often end up creating together as a result of the relationships that are forged here.
Yeah.
And not in a gross way, not in like a networking kind of, I'm trying to get something out of this that other sort of film festivals or Hollywood events can sort of elicit.
No.
This is a genuine space
passion.
Where everyone is equal and they're united based on their love of film. And real things come out of this. Nacho Vigalondo, you know, has been to this festival. I'm sure you guys have met him many, many times.
He just came to my dad's class. Yeah.
Right? I got to work with him as a result of forging a relationship here. There's just so much that comes out of that. And that is an extension of my love of a working environment, working with a group of people who love something and want to see it get made.
Elijah, it's inspiring hearing you say these things. It really is.
Thank you.
That you've spent, I mean, it's great. You've spent your life in this business and it hasn't jaded you. You know, it hasn't beaten you down. It's done the opposite. It's lifted you up.
Yeah.
And I think that's, you should be an inspiration to young people who want to pursue this, that it can be positive. It can be
done
nourishing.
Done the right way.
Nourishing.
Yeah, yeah, it can be.
And good for you. And thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah.
Oh, thank you.
Here on our show.
What an honor. Thank you so much.
And
thank you so much.
If we always ask, are you available on social media?
I am. Elijah Wood at Twitter.
Okay, that's simple enough. Yeah. Jesse, are we available on social media?
Or Twitter, at Elijah Wood, however that works. Yeah.
All those things, at Leonard Maltin, at Jesse Maltin on Twitter and Instagram, and your website, www.leonardmaltin.com, for movie reviews, book roundups, and articles about festivals like this one.
You guys are so great. What a delight.
We have fun.
I have grown up with you, so this is really an honor for me as well.
Thank you.
I've stalked you, so it's the same. It totally works out.
It's a love fest. That's what it is, friends. And thanks to everybody here at the Highball.
Thanks, guys.
At Alamo Drafthouse Lamar in Austin, Texas. And for all of you listening at home or wherever you're listening, we'll see you next week. Bye-bye.
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 Now leaving Nerdist.com.
No algorithm has ever cried during a tearjerker or laughed at a comedy or watched a single movie, for that matter, which is why an algorithm has no business choosing your films. Mubi is a curated online cinema streaming exceptional films from around the globe. Every day they introduce a new gem and you have 1 month to watch it. Right now they're featuring brand new films from around the world that are playing at this year's New York Film Festival, as well as classics like David Lean's Breaking the Sound Barrier. Whether it's a timeless classic, a festival darling, or an acclaimed masterpiece, each film is hand-selected by experts. Maltin on Movies listeners are invited to try Mubi free for 30 days at mubi.com/Maltin. That's my name, Maltin, M-A-L-T-I-N. So give Mubi a try. And thanks to Mubi for sponsoring Maltin on Movies.